Well, hello there. Good evening and welcome to the number one technology radio show in Ghana. You're welcome to City Trends. This is 97.3 City FM and my name is Philip Ashon. You are most welcome to the show. Today's show is rather packed and I believe you're going to enjoy it because we are going to move to Kumasi to find out what the vibe is in Kumasi regarding the technology ecosystem there. We'll be bringing you all those details and more. But remember, the show is sponsored by Hubtel. Now, big question, do you have an e-commerce plan for your business? The reason why I'm basically asking is because more and more of your customers are using smartphones, they're going online, they're paying with cards and mobile money. Now, Hubtel is the e-commerce platform for your business today. It works every time you do business in your store online or even on mobile. Sign up today to set it up as a POS software in your store, your shop, your branch, your restaurant, or any other. Grab a card reader to accept payment and get a web store to sell your customers online. Go to hubtel.com to start today or simply dial *713# right now. Hubtel, rethink customer service. On the show today, we have a very, very interesting conversation with Yao Edujenfi about skills development, innovation, and knowledge sharing all the way in Kumasi. We also have the trending and app segment coming your way, but you can be a part of the show with your comments. 054-986-996 is the WhatsApp number. You can send in your comments. You can also reach out to me via Twitter using the handle at Kofi Ashon. Alternatively, reach us using the hashtag CityTrends and we'll get to your messages. Well, if you're ready, CityTrends is live and interactive. We're going to start off with the how-to segment, and Jeffrey Oreku Sapon has some tips if you are wondering and worried about switching lenses on your camera today.
Hello and welcome to the how-to segment on City Trends. Tonight, we are learning about how to keep your camera sensor dust-free when changing lenses. Will changing lenses mean I end up with dust on the camera sensor? So much has been said about the situation where small particles of dust that land on your camera sensor and cause dots in images. This makes many DSLR and mirrorless photographers skeptical about changing lenses. Yet, being able to use the best lens for any particular shot is one of the best attractions to DSLR and mirrorless photography. Don't be afraid to change lenses when you need to, but take a few precautions. Always switch the camera off, as this removes any static charge from the sensor that can attract dust particles. Where possible, choose a dust-free non-windy location when changing lenses too. If that's not possible, at least shield yourself from the wind. Next, get the replacement lens ready to fit so that you don't have to waste time with the camera internals exposed. Finally, keep the camera lens opening pointing downwards when changing lenses to minimize the risk of anything falling into it.
Well, it's a brilliant evening right here on 97.3 City FM. And as you know, on City Trends, we engage engaging minds, for want of a better description, about how we can grow the technology base in this country, how we can grow the technology ecosystem in this country, how we can set ourselves apart from the rest of the world and still stay ahead while we are at it. And my guest today is someone who not just talks about it, but is actually working at it, is actually putting it on paper, is actually doing research about how we can do this and have it more sustainable. And I'm really, really excited to have him in the studio. It's such a pleasure for him to join us. I know it's taken quite a lot for him to do that, but I am more than glad that he finally made it. Yao Edujenfi is my guest, and this is a man who has basically set aside a portion of his life, probably all of his life, to basically researching about what is happening in Kumasi, trying to understand the issues of knowledge sharing, the issues of innovation, the issues of technology growth and development in Kumasi. And he has put out a very interesting bit of research document. He did this with Benson Ejay, and the title is Skills Development, Knowledge and Innovation at Swami Magazine, Kumasi. Working Paper 16, this was published on the 4th of September 2018. So this is very fresh knowledge about what's happening in Kumasi. And yeah, it's such a pleasure to have you in the studio. Thank you so much for joining
us. Thank you very much, Ashon.
So what led to this?
So it's pretty much a long story. And I would say my fascination with Swam Magazine began in, in the mid of 1990s, when I used to sell ice water. At the Swam Magazine, I used to sell ice water and meat pie for my
That's
mom.
Interesting.
And so, I mean, you walk around and you see all these fascinating fabrications that are being churned out by the artisans. It was fascinating for me, and also the sort of cacophony at the time. I mean, when you're moving around, you see you hear all these noise, and I say beautiful noise. I mean, like people hammers hammering away, people chatting.
I can imagine.
And vehicles.
For a young man, this will be fumes. This will be an explosion of joy almost.
I mean, this is like
color and
we're
sound.
Talking about huge, one of like the arguably the biggest informal industrial cluster in West Africa. So it's a huge area. I mean, if you're a young person and you happen to be walking around this, you'll be fascinated. And so fast forward after my undergraduate days, I did my national service in Asante, Aguna. After that, I teamed up with a couple of other people to come up with the first ICT news magazine. And during that period, there was advocacy by artisans at the Swam Magazine. We're talking around 2006, 2007. The Dynamic Spare Parts Association, led by the 2014 National Best Farmer, Mr. George Amankwa, who is now set up the, I think, Ashanti's first 1D1F, One District, One Factory, to manufacture boats and nuts.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, he was leading this vibrant advocacy, sort of letting Ghanaians know about the challenge at Swam Magazine, which is innovation stagnation, and also letting people know about the consequences of not addressing these things, and also the opportunities that if we're able to address these things, we can address some of the challenges. And what was this? I mean, they're talking about technology, improving technology, and artisans not being able to keep pace with the technology, especially those who are fixing vehicles, fabricating parts, and also those who were into fabricating different aspects of tools and equipment for even the food industry, agriculture. Those who do the grinding, they do the grinding plates, the corn mills, and agricultural implements, simple ones that sort of empowered our farmers. And so I was fascinated by it, and fortunately, they came to Kofi Annan Center of Excellence in ICT, and what we were doing in Kumasi then, which was the first ICT newspaper, and also doing some ICT training. We had partnerships with the Kofi Annan Center of Excellence in ICT. And so we met. They introduced us and said, hey, these guys are doing some marvelous work at a Swam Magazine. Maybe you could teach them ICT so that they appreciate what they are talking about. So I got involved in 2008. I got involved. I helped to set up the ICT center, and also with the computers that were donated by Kofi Annan Center of Excellence in ICT. And so we started teaching them. And, and what we did was to develop a curriculum with some volunteers that, that we collaborated with from Canada. And one of the things that I made sure we did was to ensure that whatever we put in the curriculum reflected the work that they did at the Swam Magazine. So if we are talking about hard drive and we are talking about system unit and things like that, we compared that to the engine of a vehicle.
So it something made, they could easily relate
to. Yeah, it
to.
Relate to, and it made sense for them. And so we started from there. At that time, it was very interesting. I was on a 150 CD stipend. And so I remember that I would go home and my mom was like, So how much are you receiving these days? Yeah. I mentioned it, and like all of that, it's taken up by transportation costs.
Yeah.
But at a time, I was hugely motivated to really understand the place and see how and connect myself to the new opportunities that are opening up. And so fast forward, I got an opportunity to become the general manager for the Swami Magazine Industrial Development Organization, SMIDO, which the advocacy led, funded by the BUSAC Fund, led into establishing. And so at the time, we developed programs and activities and projects, developed value chains, and also built capacity. But then I started research from there. So around 2010, we did some research, collaborative research with two other colleagues of mine, Rachel Alexander and Mary Wilcox, who were working with us at the time. And so we sort of tried to understand the issues there and also document some of the challenges. And I think that that's when we sort of highlighted that integrated approach to addressing some of the challenges, because their challenges were not just building capacity, but were also included looking at issues of land tenure, because a lot of those who were involved in the innovation, the small artisan shops and things like that, were involved in innovation, you know, doing try and error, and also helping people with solutions. They didn't have tenure to the land, and so you had all these spare parts dealers who had the money buying these guys off, you know, because the owners of the land didn't appreciate that these guys were working in technology and they needed to zone these areas. So they'll buy them off and then, you know, start putting up all these buildings. And so I think partly it led to people, you know, stopping what they were doing because they didn't have the support. And also it got to a point where if you go to some magazine these days, where on along the street where Cow Bank is, Room Hotel, going down, former Intercontinental Bank, you see that there used to be a lot of donkey carts, a lot of agricultural implements, a lot of innovation on that stretch of the road. But when development, if elsewhere you say gentrification, but when development, you know, infrastructural development, I mean, people were building these huge buildings, putting up these huge buildings, caught up, they had to leave. And most of them have stopped working in the Swami Magazine. So you're no more seeing a lot more of such innovations, which propelled agriculture, especially in the hinterlands. And so we did some research from there.
That's a very interesting thing that you talk about, whereby a lot of us feel that, of course, with the uprising of or coming up of these tall buildings and these facades, more or less, of growth, the real work of innovation and building and putting one and two together to create solutions for the average person was actually being killed as a result of these so-called developments, as people typically would
look at. It's scattered development. I mean, like, this is just infrastructure. You know, banks coming up because they think they've seen opportunities to work with these artisans. But they are not empowering the artisans. They are there for the artisans' money. Mostly, I would say they are there for the spare parts dealers. But the spare parts dealers only entrench imports. You know, they don't encourage innovation. It's only when, and I in my research, we discussed some of the policies of government then. That's private sector impact. But then policies of government, let's say in the 70s, for instance, where government decided that we're no more importing. At the time, Yuntriaka, Champon's regime, you know, it encouraged a lot of innovation. You know, even though it was an unpopular policy then, but it encouraged innovation. How? What it did was to sort of encourage the artisans to make replacement parts, because we're not importing the parts. So especially, you see that the trucks needed bolts and nuts. And so at the time, the Kwame Nkrumah University of Science and Technology, through the Technology Consultancy Center, had also set up the ITTU, which is the Intermediary Technology Transfer Unit. So the ITTU basically was transferring knowledge from the ivory tower of Noost to this unplanned, clustered, industrial cluster or sector some magazine.
Mainly necessity being the mother of invention in that sense. And now it appears over the period that the necessity sort of have been taken away as a result of obviously imports and things like that.
So, and it's partly because of some of the challenges that were highlighted on, but then also by government policy. Because what happened in the afterwards, when in the 70s, encouragement of replacement parts, news had come in. That's when they brought in the capstan lathes. They brought in all these equipment. And also an industrial furnace that helped them to be able to then do a lot more foundry fabrication, be able to build the bolts and nuts for the trucks that were cutting cocoa from the hinterlands. And even bolts and nuts all the way to here in Accra, to support the fishing industry, because at the time there was innovation around building bigger boats, and so some magazine artisans were supplying those boats and nuts. And fast forward to the 80s, where we started doing the structural adjustment programs and things like that. You see, we liberalized, and so what happened was that all that innovation stagnated, because now people who go for replacement parts have parts coming in. And so, I mean, you can juxtapose that or compare that to the policy now. I think last year, when the MPP government said that we are reducing taxes on spare parts. Of course, I mean, if you are using a vehicle, you say, hey, that's good. Or if you're a spare parts dealer, you say, hey, that's good. But then it kills thousands of of jobs and of innovation. Because if I can buy a new part, why would I want to do a replacement part? And also stifles innovation. Because we've liberalized the market to the point that everything is imported, including sickle, that previously were done by these artisans. And we are not putting in place the structures like was done with the support of NUST to be able to establish the Intermediary Technology Transfer Unit to not just empower through skills development, but then also share knowledge. You have professors coming there and helping to encourage and support the innovation process. And you had tools that were transferred to these artisans through higher purchase program.
Which so is not happening anymore.
It is not. So you what happened was that within the value chain, they got support from everywhere. And so they had the skills, they had the knowledge, they had the markets. And they are the tools.
And they're even encouraged to invest more into learning about how to do things differently.
Exactly.
How to take on new technology and use to solve the problems. Because I can imagine if a few years ago they were having difficulties creating, quote unquote, these bolts and nuts, for example. And there is a new mechanism by which they can do it faster, do it safer, increase in the quantity. I think that that will be a catalyst for them to want to even learn some more or even pick up new skills.
Yes.
But then that is not happening because of the policies that we've put in place.
You know, and so magazine is also a hub for skills development. So once you are empowering all these spare parts dealers through policies, intended and unintended, with intended and unintended consequences, what you're doing is that you are stifling innovation. You are preventing a lot more young people from apprenticing with other masters, because these masters, they will lose their jobs. I mean, they will just fall along the way. They cannot apprentice with spare parts dealers. These are business people. You go there and do just bookkeeping or inventory control. You're not learning any hard skill. You know, you're not adding value. So once you're empowering a lot more of these spare parts dealers, and you're not encouraging them to sort of go into manufacturing, what you're doing is that we are killing artisan work. You are killing artisanal engineering. And that's what has been going on to the point where now artisans who are into fabrication, who are into even welding, who are into foundry work, which is to fabricate metals, are not competitive. They cannot compete with imported similar goods or products, especially from China. I'm saying that. I mean, sickle is imported. I mean, we used to do sickle at some magazine. And all of these, so it what we are experiencing now is innovation stagnation, as we put in the research. And we've made a number of recommendations as to how to
address we'll be coming to the recommendations in a bit, but I was hoping that you could and this is City Trends on 97.3 City FM. We are having a conversation with Edu Jenfi, who basically is a researcher, and he's put out a very interesting bit of research with some colleagues of his, and titled Skills Development, Knowledge and Innovation at Swami Magazine. And you can grab a copy and basically get to understand what is going on in Swami Magazine as an extension, more or less, or giving you a good understanding of what is going on within that particular metropolis and how it can, the opportunities there can help us propel our technology industry. Apart from some of the challenges, what are some of the unique challenges that are hindering technology growth within the Swami Magazine? Kumasi generally.
Yeah, I would say relevant skills. I would say access to markets. I would say access to tools and equipment, and also land tenure issues, and also the opportunities for the industrial cluster, which I would say it's now very crowded. Opportunity for the area to be redeveloped. So I'll take that one after the other. So for skills, for instance, because there's innovation stagnation, what is happening is that these master crafts people who sort of pass on the skills are passing on skills that are decades old, and knowledge that are decades old. You know, one of the areas that we highlighted as the how in knowledge and skills are shared within the cluster is through apprenticeship. And in apprenticeship, people go to masters and, 6 years or 5 years, and then they gain knowledge, they practice on the job and things like that. But if you go to a master who, for instance, knows nothing about onboarding on vehicles and how to use diagnostic tools to be able to diagnose vehicles.
What are they going to pass on to?
What they are passing on to you is what they know. So sometimes they tarnish the brands. So you go and then they remove a part and fix it. It's innovation. Don't get me wrong. It's innovation. But what is happening is that they're not giving you something that is efficient. And so that's the challenge. And you have thousands of young people passing through the Swami Magazine as apprentices. And so with this innovation stagnation, what is happening is that people along the line lose interest because it doesn't become profitable anymore to be an artisan. Most of them have become drivers. Others, unfortunately, sometimes go into other vices, which may not help the country. So skills. Relevant skills is one of the key issues. How to mitigate that? We make a recommendation about digitization, about for government, for instance, to be able to support the process, because you still have the ITTU at the Swami Magazine or the center that NUST put up, is to be able to retool the ITTU and also ensure that we have relevant skills, because now these days it's about digitization, about digital manufacturing.
Because I was going to ask about documentation of processes, for example, because it's vital if you're going to pass on information. And my guess is that a lot of them don't have a process of documenting some of this knowledge to even pass on to their apprentices and things like that.
Yes, and some of them do, because some of them are also educated. I mean, you have about 1% who are tertiary literates, and so that's very low, but then you have that number there who document, but then you have a lot more who don't. And so it becomes much of a problem. But there are opportunities beyond the NUST ITTU. There's also the Kumasi Vocational Training Institute, or NVTI, it used to be NVTI, so which is also within the Swami Magazine. However, it's all about how many of these do we have? You're talking about 200,000 population and still growing with lots of young people. And so you need more of such places. We call them industrial hubs. So you need to have industrial hubs. And government don't necessarily need to do it. You need to be able to create that environment. For instance, Swami now is a municipality. So we need to create that environment where there are incentives for the private sector to be able to provide such facilities. How would that be? We need to rezone the place. The place is too clustered. We need to rezone it. We need to deal with the land tenure issues, and we need to deal with the fluctuating power. Because at the swap magazine, if you're not careful and you put digital equipment there, it becomes a problem. Mm-hmm. So once you have government addressing these issues, government, not just government, but government and its stakeholders addressing these issues, you create that environment where private people can then invest and put up industrial hubs that would ensure that when you send your vehicles there, you know, properly fixed, they can fabricate parts, and they can also build linkages. For instance, with VW, VW is coming in by the end of the year. We need to build linkages to ensure that at least some magazine gets to, or some magazine artisans, and artisans across, not just some across Ghana, get the opportunity to be able to have some skills built, so that it doesn't become like, okay, so if you have a VW vehicle, it's only certain the plush motors, you know, the areas that you can be able to, because sometimes it also has a dip in your pocket. But if you have a lot more people who know, it's in the interest of VW and of a government. Your government needs to create jobs, needs to build capacity. VW needs to ensure that its brand is not damaged, and ensure that also you have a lot more people who can service the vehicles so that they can sell more. And so you need to have that, create that synergy, so that we don't just put up VW assembly point, and then bring in the parts and every other time.
We can do that here.
Yes, we can build capacity, because these guys, they know what their stuff. You can build capacity and ensure that you do that here. Kumasi is very unique. We have Neoplan. In Neoplan, they have a branch here at Achimota. But the headquarters is in Kumasi.
Oh, really?
At Abrepo Junction.
Interesting.
And that's where they were, you know, building all these vehicles, the Udisaka and all those vehicles. They were
building parts.
So it has that that character as an industrial region for vehicles, you know, vehicle assembly and for, you know, repair, skills development in the automotive sector, and metallurgy as well. And so we only need to build the synergy and also build the right partnerships and create that enabling environment for Kumasi, which is also central. And from there, you can get to most parts of Ghana easily to become a hub, not just for VW and also building the skills of these artisans, but for other vehicle assemblies that we've been told will be coming in. So that we're not just creating opportunities for Europeans, but we're creating opportunities for our own people as well.
Sharing knowledge as well.
And sharing knowledge. And I know that Scania, for instance, for they do the buses.
Yes.
They're also looking for opportunities to assemble some of their parts here. Yeah, I mean, it's not official, but they want to do that. But if I'm not seeing any deliberate policy from government to be able to do that, and to be able to not just the automotive industry, but to be able to also link these artisans to the mining industry. Bauxite is coming up, and again, it's in the Ashanti region. To be able to link these the artisans to also the oil industry. For welding, for fabrication, these guys have been sitting there doing welding and fabrication for 8 decades,
and we just don't seem to realize the opportunity that is available to us to empower them to actually build from inside.
Let me give you some statistics. I mean, if you look at 200,000 estimated people working there, not just artisans, but different shades, you know, traders, artisans, what have you, and each of them on a lower variant is making $5 a day. We're looking at $1 million of transaction around the Swap Magazine.
Yeah.
I mean, when you say this, maybe there's some municipal guys who will be giddy. But the thing is, you need to create that environment for them to give you that money.
Yeah.
Or for you to ensure that that player, money that is circulating
within
growth.
Yeah.
I mean, how do you do that? You know, proper roads, you know, effective power. And efficient power, not fluctuating, ensuring that environmental issues are catered for, you build capacity, ensuring that artisans, we create that a scheme. It's been done before, you know, through NUST, and also building that high purchase program. You need to build high purchase program to ensure that we can put artisans in groups so that they can access modern equipment, for instance, you know, whether it's digital manufacturing tools or a CNC machine or 3D printing, so that if you want a pattern made for you at some magazine, they can just 3D print it. And then they know that it is how it's going to look like. They can even cost it. They can do the dimensions very well. And then so when they set out to go and to make the product, they don't do try and error and waste raw material.
They know exactly what they're doing.
Yes. So, and these things are opportunities. I mean, when you do that, you're not just creating, because it's in Ashanti region, you are creating opportunities for only residents there, but you're also creating opportunities within the middle sector of the country to ensure that you don't have this number of people coming all the way to Accra and choking the capital, and you're spending a lot of money on sanitation, and also you have to redesign the place just because there are a lot more people.
There's a lot of rethinking that appears needs to be done. But one of the things that bothers me, and from some of the things that you're saying, it appears that there seems to be a divide in the definition of what innovation is, and it's something that keeps coming back at me, because it feels on one side, probably the younger population will feel that innovation is having a technology hub, or you know, having computers and programming and things like that. And there's a population that also believes in the vocational and things like that. Do you see this difference in the understanding of what innovation is being a problem, or probably is a myth that probably we are cooking up?
So I'm a researcher with the Open African Innovation Research, and we're basically looking at researching on innovation in Africa, and also demystifying the myth that there's no innovation moving on the continent, especially not just with high tech innovation, but we are also looking at cultural innovation, indigenous innovation. We're looking at high-tech hubs. We're looking at metrics, and also metrics on innovation, because you see, Africa does poorly on the innovation metrics when you index, because most of the innovation that we do are not measured with patents, are not measured with copyrights and all of these things. So we don't appear on that index. But then we, within our network, we are there's a North African hub that has been taxed with, and they've come up with it, with metrics for measuring innovation. And here, innovation is not technology. So there's process innovation. For instance, somebody makes a handkerchief, and you add a process to it to make sure that maybe the handkerchief, instead of putting it in your pocket and removing the handkerchief and wiping your face with it, the handkerchief, you know, wipes your face somehow, but it's still a handkerchief anyway.
Yeah.
You've added a process to it, or maybe when you wipe your face, it doesn't get dirty. Maybe, you know,
it has something.
Or let's move to the Swan magazine, where you send your vehicle to Swan magazine. It's a VW, but then instead of replacing it with a genuine part, they're able to create a new part similar to what they've done. So they've improved on the process. It's the same thing. Somebody would say copying. But they've added just a small change and improved on the process. Or sometimes they even the efficiency of the vehicle. That's innovation. It's not copying. Because they've improved on the process. So what our other research, our colleague researchers are looking at, is to come up with new set of metrics for measuring innovation on a continent. So they're looking at the fact that in Africa, most of our innovation, you see, like Swan Magazine, for instance, it happens at the apprenticeship level.
Right.
It's collaborative, right. You know, and it's about openness and sharing.
Right.
So it's not about, I have this innovation, I just hide it, I go for a patent, you know. But people are like, they're free to share. And there's, you know, first to market. So first to market becomes the opportunity for your innovation to go out there and for you to make some money out of it. However, within our research, we got to a point where we asked the question of what people know about intellectual property and what they think about it. But, I mean, you find out that the 6 out of 10 would say that they need some form of protection. Not necessarily intellectual property protection. It could be that they are sharing within the association of welders. But they need maybe recognition. So we need to put, ensure that, some recognition is given to this person. For instance, the one who came up with the fufu machine.
Yes.
It's poor. Because maybe he's not recognized. Because when recognition comes, some reward.
Yes. And that doesn't happen.
That doesn't happen. And that's, I think we should be more tailored, because the informal sector innovation is more around that area. So we should be more tailored towards highlighting these avenues for people to come up with their research, continue to share, but then there's some bit of protection to ensure that there's recognition, there's also some monetary rewards going on after.
What's the level of collaboration between what I'll probably describe as the newfound technologists and the old
That's an interesting question, because one of the objectives was to find out whether some magazine artisans know about the maker movement and whether the maker movement can become an enabler. So the maker movement started, it gets into this do-it-yourself attitude, DIY, and hacker spaces, maker spaces, and things like that. So it's a movement all geared towards digitization and digital technologies. And so the recommendation and one of the objectives for us was to look at, okay, do people know about the maker movement? When did the maker movement start in Ghana? Fab labs, hack labs, maker spaces, and other things. But you see that when you discuss with these artisans, they've had some collaboration with them because of NUST. Because NUST has a center, and so makers come there from MIT with NUST students, and then they are there working on innovation. The artisans think that what they do is more academic. See. Because, you know, for the artisans, they are motivated by access to market, and monetary rewards. So if you come up with an innovation and it cannot sell, or you cannot replicate, or you cannot scale, they think that is just for academic purposes. They don't pay attention. So there's a gap. It's a huge gap. And I think for us, and that's something that I've been pushing within the Ghana Hubs Network, and also with George Apia of Kumasi Hive, to ensure that we get closer, we get the makers closer. Not just to go to the news center, do their thing and go, but to get closer to the artisans, work with them, and churn out innovations that can scale. You know, I know that with the School of Engineering, they attach some of their students to go to these, to the foundries and to some of the workshops. But that is not enough. I'm talking about churning innovations that makes money, that economically empowers. Right. That is what interests the artisans. That is what perhaps would interest most of us as well, because you need, and for government, because the municipal assembly needs to tax. But as I said, they need to provide certain incentives to ensure that you're not just taxing to kill, in quotes, but then you are taxing to be able to provide the sort of amenities that are needed within the some magazine. So as at now, there's a gap. But we are working to set up the some magazine innovation hub to ensure that we have a lot more digitization, because we think that if an artisan has a 3D printer and knows how to use it, they can pass on that knowledge to hundreds of other artisans. And what you're doing is that you are introducing digital manufacturing into the some magazine and new skills that will interest especially young people. And for us as customers, what is happening is that there'll be precision with the sort of the manufacturing that they will do, because at least with the patterns they made, they will know the dimensions, waste. And less waste in the raw material and things like that, and there will be precision in the product that they give you.
Listeners, this is City Trends on 97.3 City FM. We're having a conversation with Yao Idujemfi, who has done extensive work about skills development and knowledge transfer and innovation. And his main area of focus was Swami Magazine in Kumasi. But obviously, some of the lessons there extend beyond Swami Magazine and goes quite beyond the confines of Kumasi. And you can extrapolate from that to sort of give you a sense of where we are headed with the growth of our technology space right here in Ghana. You speak a lot about opportunities that are available that you can see using Swami Magazine, of course. What are the opportunities that are available, and what lessons can we learn from Kumasi Swami Magazine that we can use to build our technology?
The opportunities are manifold. I mean, we have a lot of young people who need jobs. There are a lot of young people at Swami Magazine that are yearning for new knowledge, yearning for new skills. So the opportunity to build capacity and the opportunity to satisfy that yearning for new knowledge. It's there, and it's something that needs to be satisfied. Kumasi has the Kwame Nkrumah University of Science and Technology. New knowledge happens all the time. Young people with vibrant ideas are churning out new knowledge. Opportunity for digitization. And with new knowledge, digitization, digital manufacturing, comes new products and services that are needed in this in the modern economy. Mm. And with that comes new jobs, income. And with income comes in with taxes. When people are making money, that's when government can make a lot more money in terms of taxes. Yeah. And then using that tax to plow back and also provide services that sort of empowers the industrial enclave. Yeah. But at the moment, what is happening is that land tenure issues, those who are engaged in the informal innovation, they don't have tenure to the land, so they are ejected anytime. Mm. And they lose their innovations, they probably stop working or they find something else to do. You find out that increasingly, there are a lot of merchants who are moving into the sector. And if you are not careful, the whole place, instead of turning into an innovation ecosystem to propel our industrialization, would turn into a merchant area, right, where people are just selling spare parts imported from Europe.
Right.
And that's what we don't need to happen. Mm. And that's what government intervention is very key in creating that enabling environment and in also replicating the success of the NUST ITTU model, which was to set up, they have the requisite tools set up and to train, to provide new markets, provide business development services, and also ensure that there's a high purchase system where artisans can acquire the needed tools and technologies.
From what you're saying, it seems, so in this case, both technologists, or as you know, the artisans call them, the theorists,
yes,
and the practitioners will understand every part of the supply chain,
yes,
how all of them connect and work together to basically provide you either profit or whatever the end game is. That's basically what you're saying.
Yeah, and you can link government policy. Government says, I'm doing 1D1F. Like I said, Ashanti's first 1D1F was set up by a mechanic. They're doing U-boats and axle and things like that. It's the second in West Africa to be doing that. So, I mean, just through policy, government intervention through policy, look at what has happened. I think government needs to be direct. And again, replicating the ITTU model, retooling the ITTU to ensure that they have the requisite tools to be able to do that. And government can do that. You know, government is forging new partnerships. There are emerging opportunities with the bauxite industry, emerging opportunities in the oil and gas industry. We need an opportunity where such centers like the ITTU will be able to take on and train new people with new skills that are required by such sectors. Because otherwise, you have a situation where companies come in, they are mining the bauxite, and they'll bring everybody, almost everybody from outside. What our people will
they'll
do will
all
be
the tools as well.
Yeah, what our people will be doing will be the mining of the vehicles, the trucks, and things like
security.
That. But we need people to also with knowledge. We've been mining in this country for a long time.
Yeah.
And so you have people in the Swami magazine who have knowledge on how to even make, fabricate the loaders, fabricate parts for the vehicles in the mining sector. I'm saying this because I've experienced it. We've developed value chain and also support initiatives where mining companies like Newmont were directly sourcing jobs from the Swami magazine.
I see.
But you need a lot more people trained
to be able to supply,
and make money from this value chain system. It's not enough for government to say that local content or this or that. Some people will be trained; they'll be chosen elsewhere to be trained. But you have people who are already in the sector,
right.
So we need a clearly defined policy to link or initiative to link policies like, local content, issues around 1D1F, issues around industrialization itself, to existing knowledge from some magazine, for instance, where you build capacity for them to be up there with the new technology, with modern skills, so that, you lift these people up
Yeah.
These are hundreds of thousands of people. You lift them up and not just keep them where they are. Where in this, right now you have a situation where there's innovation stagnation going on, mm-hmm. and so their level of skills is low, their income is low, poverty is rife.
Yeah. Oh, well, yeah. There's a lot of work to be done, clearly. Where would you say we should start from?
I think we should start from now the Swami magazine, it's a municipal area. We should start from a point where the Swami municipal area and the Tafu municipal area, those that own the land, together with the chiefs of these places, deal with the land tenure issue. It's a big issue, because if you build capacity right now, and then the issue of land tenure, people who are supposed to use that capacity to build, they don't have the money to be able to
get to
be able to compete with merchants who have cash, a lot of it, because you're basically selling and selling, and selling is booming. They lose out. They probably move out of the Swami magazine into some obscure corner, or they stop the work. So we need a situation where the land tenure system is dealt with. We need a definite policy on Swami magazine where we say, okay, this place is going to remain an industrial hub. And so A, B, C, D needs to happen. First, we deal with the land tenure issue. We make it possible for people who want to own the land to own it. We rezone the place to ensure that the place is decongested. Now it's, you know, congested with, crammed with too many people. And with new areas along the road towards Ofinso, to ensure that we can be able to move people there, government supporting, building international partnerships to ensure that if foundry people want to move away and move into towards Ofinso, they have the land, but they need equipment, industrial finances that are digital. Then government needs to be able to facilitate or help, just like they're doing for companies under 1D1F, to be able to facilitate so that such people have the equipment to be able to set up. Because once they set up, they are solving one of the biggest challenges that is happening. I mean, when those who are the foundry people are the ones that are making the greatest, the corn meal plates.
Interesting.
And research from NUST, from the metallurgy department, the engineering department, they've done research that highlights the fact that Swami grinding plates were out, you know, 5 to 8 times faster than the imported ones. So what is happening is that a lot more of our kenke, I mean, I'm not scaring anyone, but a lot more of our kenke, the pepper, and tomatoes, all of these things on the commercial market where, you know, it is grinded, have a lot more of iron filings far beyond what our bodies can contain. So, I mean, you can imagine what is happening. So there's a major health issue
as well.
I mean, I'm not saying that because of this, government just move in and say, hey, standards, ensure standards, and then you go and kill the industry. But then you move in with a plan that is hooked onto ensuring that there's proper, effective land tenure system, the place is decongested, you rezone the area, and you support those, for instance, those in the foundry industry with the necessary skills building, and also the opportunity for them to own new equipment and pay over time, just like they're able to facilitate for companies under the 1D1F. And what happens is that such people who are producing these products and services and with these hardcore technical skills will be able to support the 1D1F and also government's drive towards modernizing agriculture, like simple implements that can be able to ensure that there's agricultural productivity. They are in the Swami magazine. They are those who have been able to come up with maize planters, like a walking stick that you can use to be able to plant maize.
Walk along.
I mean, come up with basic appropriate technology tools to ensure that. I mean, no, you can't say that you know, peasant farmers elsewhere would have to go for all these combined harvesters and things like that. But the appropriate technology that, for instance, each year there's a pre-season event for agriculture that happens in Tamale. And so I get the opportunity to go there. You find out that some of the products that are being imported are very simple tools that, you know, artisans in some magazine are far more sophisticated and can do if they have the support. But we are importing these. So there's no wonder that you have pressure coming on the city, because we are importing almost everything. And so if government has long-term interests in ensuring that the city remains stable and even gain grounds, policies that like on agriculture, on 1D1F, industrialization, needs to be anchored around also building the capacity of artisans in different ways, so that they're able to, we are able to produce and manufacture some of these items that we normally import. And then we can also export. Because don't forget, so magazine also supports the Sahelian economies. Mali, Burkina Faso, Niger, Cote d'Ivoire. Cote d'Ivoire is not Sahelian, but the Cote d'Ivoire, Togo. And so Ghana is an industrial informal sector hub supporting all these economies. And so once we're able to develop that, what you're doing is that you are booming the industry. You're creating more jobs. You are ensuring that a lot more innovation, a lot more technologies are developed. You're ensuring that young people from tech will get jobs to do, new jobs to do at some magazine, yeah, and not have to come and worry you about jobs. But you're also expanding your economy.
Yeah.
Because this is a new area. You're expanding your economy and also linking that economy to other West African economies and ensuring that you have a lot more people who are earning more than they are doing now.
Well, I'm blown away. I don't know about you doing the listening, because it appears that there's a lot more work, but we don't need to start from the bottom, because quite a lot of the work has already been done. We just need to tap into the knowledge and then run with it. That's one of the biggest takeaways for me from this conversation. Yeah, it's been such a pleasure having you on the show. Thank you so much for the knowledge. Thank you so much for making time to join us. And it looks like, even though, yes, like I said, there's work to be done, a lot of the thinking has been done. All we just need to do is put our money where our mouth is and get some work done.
You're welcome. And this research is funded by the kind courtesy of Open Air. Open Air is funded by the IDRC of the Canadian government.
Mm.
And we are African researchers spread across the continent and undertaking different types of research. We call it grounded research, because you sort of go in, you pick a case study and you study it and come up with hard facts.
More sociological.
Yeah. And so this the research is out there. We've made recommendations on policy. We've given historical perspectives. We've highlighted some of the challenges. And we've shown the way as to how to ensure that some magazine becomes an effective tool for industrialization. And I think that is something that government needs to take a serious look at, and I'm prepared to work with the various sector ministries and ministers, and also, you know, private sector actors and academia to be able to ensure that some of those policies and recommendations that we've put out there are implemented.
Brilliant. So how can people access this report?
It's online. If you go to openair.org.za, and you type some magazine, the research will be there. Or you type my name, Yawadu Jemfi, the research will be there. Or you type skills, development, knowledge, and innovation at Swam Magazine, the research will be there. It's free.
Brilliant. Well, yeah, thank you so much once again for making time with us. Listeners, the conversation continues on City Trends. I mean, we are saturated with knowledge, but then we continue with the show. We still have the app segment of the show coming up. Jumping straight into the app segment of the show with Jeffrey Orekusapong.
So my first app for this evening is called HelloSign. Now, with this app, you can sign onto any document without having to print it. So whether it's a PDF or you want to take a photo and sign on it, all you have to do is open the app. If it's a PDF, import it from your, say, your email into the app, and then sign with either your finger or a stylus, and it will look exactly like your own signature. So you don't have to go around looking for a printer to print the document, sign, and then scan again. All you have to do is use HelloSign, which is available on both Android and iOS, and then you will be able to sign in the app on your phone or on your mobile device. My second app is a password manager. It's called LastPass. Now, this app, you are able to save your password so that you don't have to remember every single password that you have. You know how unsafe it is to use the same password for every account that you open. So with LastPass, you save your old password. If you want to get another password and you're not sure what to do, it will generate a new password for you, and then you use that, and you won't necessarily have to remember because it will save it for you. All you have to do, if it's on your mobile, download it, and then install it, and then if you've forgotten, it will remind you, and then just put the password in there for you.
And now Farida Shaibu is here with the trending segment of the show.
Hello, Phil. Have you guys ever wondered what the R stands for in the iPhone? But according to Apple's senior vice president of worldwide marketing, that's Phil Schiller, he says it doesn't stand for anything. They just put it there for fun. iPhone X, R, M, S, whatever, doesn't stand for anything. They just use it for the sake of it. So actually, this year's XS, XS Max, and of course, the puzzling name XR doesn't really stand for anything. But we know that the X is actually the 10, which is where they've gotten to. We don't know what is going to happen with the 11. Probably XI, RXI, something. Maybe something like that will happen. But they are saying that it doesn't really stand for anything. But initially, when they brought the 4S before, they said the S stood for the Siri. You know, I think that was when they started with the, you know, Hello Siri and all that. And at a point, they also said the S stood for speed when they continue to bring all those S series. So moving on, talking about phones, Samsung said they are in the process of coming out with a foldable laptop. I think we've heard about this a lot of times. Initially, it was the phone, right?
Yeah.
We were told that they were going to bring some phone. So moving on, we are done with phones, but YouTube is doing something amazing. I don't know how anyone would, you know, because sometimes I feel like these tech guys, they don't do anything for free, even though you'd be thinking that, oh, they're doing you a favor or something like that. But this time around, YouTube said they are going to invest in education for $20 million. They're going to invest, yes. They're going to use about $20 million and put it in education. So, of course, it has to be with content regarding education. So, for instance, channels like TEDx, which is normally TEDx Talks and TED Talks, and then people use it and then people watch. Some are inspiring. I think even in Ghana here, it's been replicated. A lot of people, TEDx Accra, TEDx Osu. Yes, so YouTube, they're going to invest in educational content like TEDx. And then creators must maintain a minimum of at least 25,000 subscribers. Ooh. So you need to have about that much of subscribers on your tube before you can qualify, you know. So as much as you're giving out the information, they need to know that people are benefiting so that they can, you know, support you. So yeah, finally, we are going to end with Amazon. Amazon is doing something, you know. I wish they would get here sooner than later. Yes, we all know Amazon, an online shopping site, if I should describe it. But now they have a convenience store where you can go and buy stuff cashless, you know, without paying for whatever you pay. So you just go there, pick whatever you want to buy. Maybe you've seen some nice laptop there, that's maybe some Surface you want to go buy. But it's not just, you just go and take
it. Why are you mentioning my dreams?
I know. You don't just go there and just take it and go like, oh, I'm a bit here. No. It's not like that. So they are saying that instead of standing in line and paying a cashier, cameras and sensors track your movement through the store after you've scanned your Amazon account at the front, and it monitors when you take off the items on the shelf. So when you leave, you are charged for what you've taken and given a digital receipt through Amazon standalone Go app. So that's it for the trending segment today.
And well, that's it for today's show. It's been such a pleasure coming your way. Thank you so much to Yadi Jemfi for his knowledge shared on the show. And of course, thanks to Farida Shaibu. Thanks also to Jeffrey Owekusapa. And thanks to you for doing the listening. The podcast is out tomorrow, so make sure you don't miss it. You can download, you can take a listen and enjoy every bit of the show that you may have missed. My name is Philip Ashon. Until next week, stay techie.